Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens to end-of-the-year learning when school lets out for the summer, and why do lower-income students lose more academic ground than their middle-class peers? Recognizing the cumulative hazards of the so-called summer slide, school systems and nonprofit groups around the country have begun to develop programs that keep at-risk students engaged in learning between grades so that they can hit the ground running in the fall instead of playing catch-up. The Wallace Foundation commissioned a study by the Rand Corporation of what the most successful summer efforts have in common and what it takes to get them going. Joining us to talk about the results of that are Rand Corporation senior policy researcher Catherine Augustine and Anne Stone, who is senior research and evaluation officer at the Wallace Foundation. They're in town to present the study Making Summer Count: How Summer Programs Can Boost Children's Learning. You can access a digital copy of the report for free online at either rand.org or at wallacefoundation.org. Catherine, Anne, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having us.
So what do we know about how practice or lack of practice over time, and I guess in this case we're talking about the summer, affects students' retention of curriculum materials?
Well, we've known for decades that summer slide is a reality. I'm sure that we've experienced it ourselves. And so when kids return to school in the fall, on average, they're about 2 months behind where they were in the spring. So they've forgotten procedural knowledge, which is often related to math skills, but also literacy-related skills as well. They've forgotten some vocabulary words, some comprehension skills. And so teachers often have to play catch-up in the fall with the students. What we haven't recognized until recently, that there's a differential impact on low-income children, that they come back to school in the fall further behind, particularly in reading and literacy-related skills, than their higher-income peers.
And what's the reason, what would explain the fact that students who've been taught the same things backslide in different ways or at different rates?
Well, that we know from survey and other research that low-income children are more likely to be playing video games during the summer. They're more likely to be watching television. They're less likely to be talking with adults. And all of those activities, or lack thereof, can contribute to summer learning loss, particularly around literacy skills, which are developed through reading or being read to at an early age, or participating in a camp experience where you're developing a script for a play or doing other literacy-related activities. And so, unfortunately, we know that that's not the reality for a lot of low-income children. Many of them are indoors for most of the summer, spending time with younger siblings, not interacting as much with adults, as I said earlier. So, you know, that's a generalization. Of course, mm-hmm. not all low-income children are in that situation, but that could help explain why we see that differential impact of the summer experience.
Does the rate at which children lose information over the summer vary according to grade level and age, things like that?
Well, it does. Students actually learn more when they're younger. Mm-hmm. that tapers off as they age, but that's also a function of the assessments that we have and that we use to measure learning. But during the summer, we see a greater loss in the early years, and that's really where the foundation is directing its resources to try to address summer learning loss early on, both because it's a big problem early on and because it can impact those children over time as well.
And I think one of the other important things to keep in mind is that the effect of this summer learning loss accumulates. Mm-hmm. So a child will forget part of what he or she learned during the prior school year over summer, come back to the fall already behind, and then the same cycle happens again and again. And so over time, you have this pretty large differential between what low-income students and higher-income students come into the school year with. And it contributes really substantially to the achievement gap.
Sure. So by middle school or something, you could have students 6 or 8 or 10 months behind their peers simply because of the summer slot.
That's right. It's one of the largest contributors to the achievement gap. The other large one is what students come into the kindergarten or first grade with. So it's what their preschool opportunities look like that are different. But in addition to that, it's the summer learning loss that contributes the largest portion to the achievement gap.
That's right. Students don't learn at different rates during the school year. So low-income students aren't, you know, performing worse during the school year compared to their higher-income peers. So it's really what's happening when they're not in school that's contributing to the achievement gap we see between lower and higher-income students in the upper grades.
So we have school systems around the country experimenting with these different programs to sort of make up for the summer slide or prevent the summer slide. How are there basic ways in which most of them are structured?
They vary. Programs look different across the country. There's a new model that many districts are embracing that tries to move away from the stigma associated with a remedial type of summer school program. Mm-hmm. And those programs tended to be half-day programs that were only focused on academics. And this new model is a full-day program, which really benefits working parents. And it combines a focus on academics with enrichment opportunities for youth, opportunities for students to, for example, learn fencing or kayaking or horseback riding. And some districts are intentionally including those opportunities in an attempt to overcome not only the academic achievement gap, but what's being called the opportunity gap, so that low-income students have similar experiences to their higher-income peers over the summer.
And I guess in terms of if this is not a compulsory program, you also have to put something in there to sort of sweeten the deal.
Right. We know that students have to attend these programs in order to benefit. There's not a halo effect associated with being admitted to a summer program.
Yeah.
You actually have to attend and attend consistently. And so advertising it as a camp is something that some districts do to attract students. Highlighting the fact that there will be these enrichment opportunities gets them to enroll in the first place and gets them excited about it and their parents excited about it as well, and then keeps them coming back. However, I will say that we surveyed children last year in summer programs across the country, and they like their math and reading courses too. So they're not just sitting through them waiting for the horseback riding. They do look forward to that, don't get me wrong, but they enjoy the entirety of these programs for the most part.
And it turns out, this was really interesting to me, that students are better off with a little bit of practice every day over a number of days than they are with one really intensive, you know, three-day blast of math or reading or something like that.
Right. Yep. Research shows us that both children and adults learn better when they're tackling a smaller chunk of material at a time and when that learning is spread out over time, and also when you cycle back to it. And so a lot of curricula these days are set up that way so that students are learning skills and then returning to those skills a few months later. They're cyclical in nature, and having a summer program that returns to skills that students had learned the previous year and previews what they'll be learning in the next year is basically a really good practice based on how we know students learn.
So you have to have this tied into the academic curriculum.
Yes, yeah, so that is one of the best practices to really, on the one hand, understand what the children maybe didn't learn as well as they could have the prior year, and also knowing what's coming up in the upcoming year and making sure you hit both the review of the concepts that they were struggling with and a preview of what lies ahead.
So do students come into these with, I mean, do they hand a transcript over to whoever is in charge of them on the first day so the teacher can say, wow, this child really needs to bone up on grammar or whatever?
That's the ideal. Mm-hmm. The ideal is that teachers would have data on students so they can pitch the instruction accordingly. That does happen in some programs, not all. And there are some programs that differ the curriculum by child, so that some children are focusing more on literacy or reading while others are focusing more on math, for example. But some programs have a one-size-fits-all model. So it really varies, but the ideal is to tailor the instruction to the individual student as much as possible.
And is there an ideal class size?
The smaller, the better. Research on summer programs in particular have shown that if the class sizes are smaller than 20, it's more beneficial in terms of, you know, us seeing better academic outcomes for the children. The goal is, as I said, to individualize instruction, and that's easier done in a smaller setting, a smaller class size.
And then there's also a look at how many adults you have for the kids, and that can be both certified instructors as well as teaching assistants. And so that allows for some more individualized instruction. And it also makes the whole model more affordable if you're not only paying for certified teachers the whole time.
Yeah, there may be, I guess, assistants who can help out that don't necessarily earn as much as a teacher, but can certainly stand there and correct work or make suggestions.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What does the day feel like in these programs? Is it work in the morning and play in the afternoon, or how are they broken up?
In many programs, that is indeed the case. In most of these programs, children are fed. So they arrive, they have breakfast. Sometimes there's some kind of morning assembly where all the children are coming together. In the districts that call these programs camps, there might be some chanting and cheering in the morning. And then students move into blocks. And in many cases, the academic blocks happen first. And sometimes that's an intentional decision because that's when children are the freshest. Other times it's a logistical consideration if teachers are working half days. And then in the programs that are full day, students would then go to lunch and then move into enrichment experiences, which really run the gamut. Some programs emphasize physical education, and so there's an athletic experience for the children in the afternoon. Some emphasize bringing students off campus on field trips and such. So they look very different across the country depending on the program, but that's a typical model. And the programs usually run until at least 4 o'clock, sometimes later, and then there'll be an afternoon snack before the children go home.
Another feature of some of these programs Catherine is talking about is that a lot of the enrichment activities are often provided by nonprofit organizations who work with the district. And so you can have community artists, you can have paleontologists, you can have others who have some particular expertise that they can bring to the kids in an activity, and they're not regular teachers. And that's part of what makes the summer program feel different, that they're not only being instructed, the children, by academic instructors.
Yeah, that it certainly makes sense that it makes every day a little exciting if they don't know what's coming up in the afternoon. I was really interested to read the information about physical education because I think it's counterintuitive for those of us who might have grown up and had all summer running around. The world's different today, and kids actually gain weight and lose physical tone over the summer often.
I know, that is surprising, and there's some recent work by a researcher whose name is actually Dr. Economist, who has documented that low-income children in particular do gain weight over the summer, and that's a surprising finding. But we also know from other research, as I mentioned earlier, that a lot of low-income children are inside a lot over the summer. There's a researcher at Johns Hopkins who's been interviewing low-income youth in Baltimore and in Mobile, Alabama, and they've been telling him that a gang avoidance strategy is actually to stay inside.
Yeah.
And so there's, again, I'm generalizing. This is not the case for all low-income children, but we do know on average that they gain weight over the summer. And so a lot of these programs are aggressively tackling that, both through healthy eating and also through physical activity.
We are talking about the results of a new study called Making Summer Count, How Summer Programs Can Boost Children's Learning. My guests this hour are Catherine Augustine, Senior Policy Researcher at the Rand Corporation, and Ann Stone, Senior Research and Evaluation Officer at the Wallace Foundation. You can find a copy of this report online, and the digital copies are free at either rand.org or wallacefoundation.org. If you've got a question or want to make an observation, we'd love to hear from you. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Ann Stone, Senior Research and Evaluation Officer at the Wallace Foundation, and Catherine Augustine, Senior Policy Researcher at the RAND Corporation. They're in town to present the study called Making Summer Count, How Summer Programs Can Boost Children's Learning. If you want to take a look at it, you can get an online copy for free at rand.org or wallacefoundation.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Is there a particular amount of time that these things need to run to really work? Is a week enough? Should it be all summer? What do we know about that?
The research that's available points to a program length of 5 to 6 weeks mm-hmm. as being most associated with academic benefits for kids. There's not a lot of definitive research about whether a four-week program would be enough, or if you expanded the time to 8 weeks, would you get a much bigger result? But generally speaking, I think what we know now is that 5 to 6 weeks is what to shoot for.
So as you're both aware, school districts in Texas and all over the country are struggling even to pay for what takes place during the regular school year. How much do these programs cost as compared with, say, an hour of instruction during the school year?
They cost about, on average, two-thirds of what it would cost for that same hour of instruction during the school year. So they tend to cost less than educating a child during the school year, which isn't surprising because there's not the same infrastructure involved in running a summer program. That said, it's an additional cost for districts. There are other interventions a district could choose, like changing the curriculum or professional development for teachers, that would replace something they're already doing during the school year rather than incur a new cost by offering a summer program. So cost is the main barrier to establishing these programs.
And you're really raising an important question, and something that we have thought about a lot in deciding how we at the Wallace Foundation can invest in summer learning and knowledge about summer learning in order to answer the questions that policymakers would have. Because if there were to be a reallocation of resources into the summer program from what happens during the regular school year, decision makers would need to feel that that is going to provide the benefits to children that would make it worth putting the extra resources into summer. And what we'll be doing over the next 4 years in partnering with six districts, school districts around the country, is to measure in a very definitive way what are the academic benefits if a school district puts on a solid summer program. What does it cost? And what kinds of policies and practices does the district need to put in place in order to sustain this kind of program and have it have the benefits that we all want? And it's with that information that we think then decision makers can figure out what is the best way to benefit low-income children, and is summer learning a core strategy that they can add to their toolbox?
So it sounds like you're saying you have yet to learn, for example, the long-term impact. If a kid does this in first through fifth grade, is he or she less likely to drop out of high school, that sort of thing? That's still ongoing, that research?
Yes, it is. I think the research is clearest, first of all, on the problem of summer learning loss. That mm-hmm. is well documented, and there is lots of research that tells us that it's real, that it disproportionately affects low-income kids, and that it's cumulative. There's also research that tells us that effective summer programs can eliminate loss and actually produce gains for children. What's not as well known is whether these kinds of programs can be applied more broadly across a school district so you can really reach the many children who need the benefits. And also what's not yet known is how long do the benefits of our summer program last? We know that summer learning loss is cumulative. We need to look very carefully and see if a child participates in a summer program for a couple years, do the benefits accumulate and do they last over time? And we think that those are the kinds of questions that need to be answered in order to make the really smart resource allocation decisions.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of the things that you've brought up are the same questions being asked currently about preschool programs that are available through public schools as an enhancement to the sort of standard curriculum and how long they last. And maybe we need everything. Maybe we need only one or the other. But it's an interesting way to look at all this. How do you tease out what is the effect of a summer program compared with what might be something else in a student's life?
Yeah, that's a great question. And really the only way to do it well is to randomly assign some students to the summer program and some students to not participate in the summer program. And so that's what the Wallace Foundation is working toward for the summer of 2013.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. First on the line, we have Diane in Dallas. Hey, Diane.
Hi, I'm a teacher in DISD. I happen to be listening to the program right now. My question for you is on scaling it up. Talking about Mobile, Alabama, and is not quite the same as talking about a district with 158,000 students like we have. My question is the long-term effects and the cost. I mean, horseback riding lessons, and we're talking about thousands of kids. I just don't see how they can say that the cost would be so much less when you deal with county buses. And also, how do you make the kids attend? We have trouble getting them to attend during the year. Our Hispanic population, a lot of them go back to Mexico during the summer. They're not even speaking English because they're not even in the country. So are those addressed in their studies about what do you do with a highly mobile population, non-English speaking, that is resistant to having their kids in the country during the summer?
Thank you so much for your call. Diane spoke so eloquently to the frustrations that teachers have when they care passionately about educating students, but they can't always get them where they need to be.
Right. Well, that's a great question. And in fact, one of the reasons we are here in Dallas is because DISD does have a summer program, and it's part of the initiative that we're working on, and they ran it last summer and served 10,000 students, and they had a 93% average daily attendance rate, the highest of the six programs we studied across the country. Now, that said, that was for a fraction of the total students in the district, of course, but it's a very successful program in terms of getting students to attend consistently, and it is less expensive than educating a student during the school year. And that's accomplished partly because it's a partnership between the district and local community-based organizations who are also bringing some of their resources in, some private sector investment. So it's a lower-cost program in general, but also lower cost to the district.
We have an email here from Kate in Euless who writes, it's common practice for public libraries to offer summer reading programs for children as an attempt to help with the academic loss. Typically, these programs include encouraging children to read during the summer by offering incentives and special enrichment type programs. Do you have any opinion about the usefulness of these programs?
Yes, we do. There have been studies of reading programs, whether they're done in a library setting, or there are even programs where kids are given books to take home over the summer with some structure. They need to read the book, answer some questions about it, write about it, and then they are sent the next book. And those programs work as well. They really help. They have been demonstrated to have positive academic outcomes on the children who participate in them. So getting kids to read over the summer is an incredibly important strategy. Reading to young children and then encouraging older children to read on their own is very important.
Are we talking, by the way, in these programs about sort of K through 8 exclusively, or even K through 5 or 6, or are there summer programs that go all the way up through high school?
They go through high school. Mm-hmm. We've primarily been studying summer programs for younger children, but high school programs typically offer what's called credit recovery programs for high school students so they can stay on track to graduate from high school and make up courses that they either haven't had an opportunity to take or haven't passed. And those programs are very successful. Kids who go through those programs are more likely to graduate from high school.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Tony in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Yeah, I was just wondering if anyone had ever tried a quarter system where you spread the time off across the year instead of having a big chunk of time off during the summer. Has any study been done on that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Great question. Yes, there are districts throughout the country that use what's called a modified calendar. So they're not necessarily providing additional days of instruction, but they're also spreading out the summer break so that there are more frequent vacations throughout the school year of shorter duration. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of good studies about that. In theory, that should help because there's a shorter break. But we don't know if those programs are as effective as offering a summer program. But offering a summer program provides additional days of instruction, and we do know that additional time on task is beneficial.
Can you talk about the reason why somebody in this country decided that 180 days of instruction is what you do? Is this really still based on the agrarian calendar and the needs of people a century ago?
It is. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's why we have it. And we have it today because of history, culture, tradition. It's what we're used to. It's what many parents prefer and want for their family situation. It's what many employers of teenagers want and what many businesses who rely on families traveling to them and partaking in their services during the summer, like theme parks, et cetera, what they want as well. So there's a lot of reasons to maintain that calendar that aren't necessarily good, you know, academic reasons.
So it sounds like it's economic as much as anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is there a lobby that says, let's not do year-round school, or is it simply something that is almost sacrosanct? I know there are districts that have experimented with it.
Yes, there are. The state of Virginia, for example, their schools start late in August or even after Labor Day because of very powerful lobbyists there who stem from the theme park industry.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Guy in Farmersville. Hello, Guy.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife is an online college professor, and it kind of brings a question for me. Have our guests studied the impact or the use of online content delivery for summer enrichment, especially in the cases of where you have working families that, you know, may not be able to get the kids to school, or, you know, addressing transportation issues or things of that nature? Have you looked at online content delivery, and what have you seen with that for summer enrichment?
I have not. I have looked at online content delivery during the school year, and it can be very effective. We've mainly been focusing on urban settings where online delivery is not as important as it is in rural settings where it's more difficult for students to travel to a centralized summer program location. But I could certainly see how some kind of online program would be beneficial for children, particularly in rural settings.
Are these programs typically administered on school campuses, even if it's not the same campus that a student attends throughout the regular year?
Most of the ones that we are studying are. Most mm-hmm. of the ones offered by districts. Not all. Some of them either have a part of the day at a school setting, and then the children are transported to a river for kayaking or to a forest for hiking. Others are set entirely in an outdoor nature setting or other location. Now, we've been talking about programs offered by school districts. There are also national providers of summer learning programs. Some of them intentionally offer their programs on college campuses to familiarize children with being on a college campus and, you know, benefit from the resources they can capitalize on there. Others intentionally structure their programs in well-resourced private schools where there are computer labs and other resources for the children. So it varies, but most of the district programs are offered in school buildings.
It does seem like they're already set up to accommodate children, and they're ready to go.
And parents are familiar with them. Mm-hmm. They know where the school is. Even if it's not their home school during the year, they're usually familiar with the school district, the busing system, et cetera. So there are reasons to keep it in a school setting.
Is there pushback from parents whose children are invited to participate in these programs? Do they say, I don't want my child having to work all summer? And you know, people do have that nostalgia for the past.
I think there are many parents who do feel that way, and they probably don't enroll their students in these programs. The RAND Corporation found in their research this past year, when they surveyed parents who whose children participated in the summer programs, was how much they appreciated having an opportunity for their children to engage in academic as well as enrichment activities, and really to have somewhere safe and productive to be for the full day. So while it's not an option that all families want to take up, it's something that is very eagerly endorsed and embraced by a lot of families.
Given the cost, do we need to limit these programs, at least for now, to lower-income students?
Well, that's a strategy that some districts are embarking on. In fact, some that had more funding in the past than they have now are narrowing the range of students they serve and just focusing either on low-income students or students who are really struggling in school.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with David in Dallas. Hey, David.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I was wondering if you or any of the panel have heard of Google Apps for Education. It's a suite of applications that Google offers to districts to help lower the cost of, you know, owning your own data warehouse is kind of expensive, and Google will do it for free. I was wondering if you guys have looked at that as sort of cost savings.
I have not, but that's a great idea. I'll take a look at it when I get back to my office.
Probably a little outside of our topic today, but it's always great to have a suggestion for something to check out.
Sure.
We have an email here from Hank in Dallas who wants to know if there's research comparing the achievement results of summer learning programs as compared with things like a longer school day or a longer school, we discussed longer school year, but are they being studied sort of in comparison to one another?
Not yet, and not really. And the issue is whether or not students benefit from more time on task. So whether that takes place in a summer program or through an extended day or extended school year really shouldn't make a difference. So we are looking at the impact of a summer program, which has its differences from expanding the school year or school day. But the core of it is providing more learning time for students. And interestingly, in the most recent PISA results, which is an international test that is taken by students in over 35 countries around the world, one of the variables that the researchers looked at was the amount of time on task, and it makes a difference. The more time dedicated to a subject, the better the students do around the country.
Catherine Augustine is with us. She's senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. Ann Stone is here as well. She's senior research and evaluation officer at the Wallace Foundation. They're in town to present the study Making Summer Count, How Summer Programs Can Boost Children's Learning. You can read a complete copy of the report online for free at either rand.org or wallacefoundation.org. And you can join our conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Ann Stone of the Wallace Foundation and Catherine Augustine of the RAND Corporation. They're in town presenting the report Making Summer Count, How Summer Programs Can Boost Children's Learning. You can check the whole thing out online for free at wallacefoundation.org or at rand.org. To join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Up next, on the phone, we have, looks like, Ian in Dallas. Hello, Ian. Is it Jan?
Yes, it's Jan.
I'm sorry. Your name's cut off on my screen. Sorry, Jan. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I was wanting to find out if there had been any research or is there an interest within, you know, more long for high school students to, as far as learning technical trades and possibly the need for extending it through the summer. I come from the dental health background on the dental laboratory manufacturing, and we have a great need to increase our workforce. And so we feel that the technical trade is a opportunistic time for these children who are, you know, with the funds kind of being allocated in different areas for students to go to college and stuff. What do you think about that?
Well, career and technical education is definitely making a comeback, which I personally think is wonderful. and a lot of schools are setting up more opportunities for career and technical education than they have had in the past. And a lot of those offerings do focus on medical and health services. The extent to which they continue into the summer, there are programs in which students then do internships in the summer that are aligned to their area of focus during the school year, which I also think is a wonderful opportunity for those youth. I don't know of research that's looked at the effectiveness of those programs and whether or not students are more likely to get better jobs or be able to do so without going on to college. But I definitely think that we're moving in the right direction in terms of resurrecting career and technical education in high schools across the country.
We haven't really talked about this, and I did not see it in the report. Forgive me if it's there and I missed it. But there have to be also some benefits to keeping kids in a structured environment over the summer with regard to behavior, you know, as opposed to being sort of out of adult supervision for 2 or 3 months at a time, as compared with, you know, going somewhere every day and having some rules and regulations.
We didn't study that directly, but that's something that teachers said all the time, mm-hmm. that they were so glad to see the students there in the summer, going through the same routines they do during the school year, staying in the habit of going to school, of thinking, of opening their books, of reading, of interacting with their peers and being respectful to their teachers, that they didn't have to spend as much time in the fall sort of reestablishing norms of behavior for the classroom. So there's probably, you know, something to that.
So maybe a free bonus that goes along with all this.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Kelly in Dallas. Hello, Kelly.
Thanks, Chris. Full disclosure, I'm a wildlife biologist, so I've got a vested interest in the question I'm about to ask.
Okay.
But I noticed that both presenters had mentioned that it was very important to get kids out in nature, and I wondered if their work was informed by the writings of Richard Love, author of Last Child in the Woods, and if not Love, was there some other salient research that had led you in the direction of trying to get the kids out in nature during the summer?
Well, districts who do have their kids outside may have been influenced by Richard Love's work, which I also know, but they're also influenced by a desire to offer children a project-based learning approach that integrates multiple subjects into a project for the children to focus on, and getting kids outside during the summer is an ideal way to get them moving, but also to spark their interest in, you know, whether it's an activity focused on bugs and insects or focused on leaves or what have you, plants growing outdoors in the summer, gardens, that can weave in lessons on math and literacy and even science and social studies. So usually the main driver is coming up with a project, and often those are most interested children in an outdoor setting.
And what do we know about schools and school districts that are doing these programs and where they're finding the funding, other than maybe calling the Wallace Foundation and saying, what can you do for us here? They have to get creative.
Yes, they do. And most of the places that are able to mount and sustain summer programs need to weave together funding from a variety of streams. So there's Title I funds that can be used for summer. There are federal funds for meals, mm-hmm. That can be used during the summer. There are often privately raised funds that complement the funding that is provided by the district. There is 21st century funding for after-school programs that can also go into the summer. So it's a complicated area to find these various revenue streams that can be braided together. And there are also often some restrictions in how these funds can be used that sometimes make folks think it's more complicated than it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real challenge in an area where we think that over the next few years, we'll have more to learn and more advice to provide folks on how to really find the range of community supports and public supports to mount summer programs.
Are there staffing challenges? I know a lot of teachers like to work during their summers off, not necessarily, once again, with children. I'm curious if there are always enough qualified professionals to hire.
There have been in the districts we've looked at. Now, remember, these districts are not serving all of the children they serve
right
during the school year, so they need fewer teachers. Some teachers might be motivated by earning an extra income over the summer. But most districts try to select teachers who are motivated to work with students who need extra attention during the summer and are familiar with that population and have demonstrated success at working with those children during the school year.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Laura in Dallas. Hi, Laura.
Hi, it's Maura with an M.
Oh, hi, Maura. Sorry.
I had a question about the achievement gap, and you said that the way that you would measure the success of the program was comparing children who low-income children who'd been in the program with low-income children who hadn't been in the program. I was wondering, for measuring the achievement gap, if you were going to test low-income children who'd been in the program against middle- or upper-income children to see how the achievement gap was closing, because I was thinking middle- and upper-income children, which my children would fall in there, do stuff all summer. We have them in science camps. We have them in nature camps. We have them in math camps. They don't get a big typical summer break because they are doing enrichment stuff all summer long. Their schools have a reading list that's required for them to complete and book reports that are required to complete over the summer. So are you going to measure that to see how it compares and how it can help them close the achievement gap?
Sure. We're going to look at both. So we'll look at how children in the program do compared to similar peers, but we'll also look at how local achievement gaps change in each of the districts we're studying. That, you're right, that's incredibly important and is, you know, top of mind for many district leaders, and, you know, how to move that stubborn achievement gap between lower and higher performing students.
We have an email here from Meredith in Dallas who writes, I believe summer programs at schools would help revive our public schools. As a middle-class mother paying out the nose for summer activities, I think it would benefit an entire community to involve all children in summer programs. I'm often confused why we separate communities according to economic background. I found that it's difficult to build a community in Dallas when everyone is running away from the schools in their districts. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. We, in some of the districts we're studying, like Pittsburgh, for example, the program is open to all children, not just low-income children. And middle- and upper-income families love the program. You know, it's free, they're provided with food, and they're taken on field trips, and they have these wonderful enrichment opportunities. They think it's, you know, the best sort of undiscovered secret in Pittsburgh. So there are districts that are not just focusing on low-income children. In our research, we tend to talk more about low-income children just because they're the ones who are more disadvantaged academically. And for policy reasons, we want to boost their academic achievement. But it's certainly not the case that all of these programs are only focused on low-income children.
Can you tell us a little bit about the program in Dallas that Wallace is studying for the next year?
Yes, it's a partnership between the Dallas Independent School District and an organization called Big Thought, which is managing a number of nonprofit organizations. These are the cultural institutions, the dance companies, the science museums that come and provide enrichment during the afternoon. And there is also investment from the city to provide a lot of the personnel, some of the artists that come in that are trained by the cultural organization. So the kids have a morning session that's focused mainly on academics, and then an afternoon where they have an opportunity to have art projects, to participate in robotics and other kinds of science activities.
Mm-hmm. So where do we go from here once we have this information and sort of know how the programs work best and how to administer them? It seems like the difference between having a program and making it better is far less than the difference between having no program and starting something.
You know, I see why you say that. On the other hand, there are sometimes very ingrained practices mm-hmm. that are hard to change. So I do feel hopeful that for communities and districts that don't have a summer program in place yet, that they could learn a lot from the research that will be produced over the next few years and the experience of school districts that are experimenting with different ways of being more effective and be able to have some guidance about how to start up summer programs. You know, I wanted to just mention that we've been talking a lot about what makes summer programs effective. There are many places that don't have summer programs, mm-hmm. you know, and especially in this tight fiscal environment, districts have often scaled back or even eliminated their summer programs. So we're really talking about what ultimately needs to be a shift in mindset about looking at the entire year as the opportunity to work with kids and help them achieve and not be focused solely on September to June. And we know that there is so much that occupies education leaders about just trying to get September to June right. But as you think about it, if it turns out that so many students are really losing ground during the summer, we all need to be thinking about that as part of our collective responsibility and what educators need to think about.
It sounds like you're saying that this is not a luxury despite what people may see it as.
Yes, that's true. And at the same time, being very cognizant of the fact that it costs money. And that's why we think it's so important to really look at this in an objective way, understand exactly what kinds of benefits can be derived from summer programs, what it costs, and what are ways to put these programs in place effectively so that decision makers can look at the balance and the trade-offs, which is always what they have to think about. But we want to have kids' achievement and their well-being be the ultimate arbiter of what resources get applied where.
Can we assume that kids who go through these programs consume fewer intervention resources throughout the regular school year, or do we know that for a fact?
We believe that's the case based on some qualitative work, and that leads to a complicated situation in which students who go through the summer program are not provided with the same interventions as a comparable student who has not participated in a summer program, which makes it hard to detect long-term effects.
Mm-hmm.
So ideally, more children who need it would be going through a summer program, which would allow the teacher to start the new year at a more accelerated pace than they do now, and all children would accelerate their learning throughout the school year.
Right. I think a very vivid example of this is that school teachers just take for granted that they have to use the first weeks of the fall to review material that was learned the prior year.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, those are resources, time, that could be better used advancing children's knowledge and skills rather than review. So if there were a way to not have that slide during the summer and not have to use the first portion of fall to do review, that would actually benefit all kids and be more cost effective.
My guests this hour have been Ann Stone, Senior Researcher and Evaluation Officer at the Wallace Foundation, and Catherine Augustine, Senior Policy Researcher at the Rand Corporation. They're in town to present the study, Making Summer Count, How Summer Programs Can Boost Children's Learning. You can check out a complete online copy at either wallacefoundation.org or rand.org. Ladies, it's been wonderful to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. The podcast is produced by Christine McConnell, and Joe Bellotti answers our phones. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.